You are listening to What Writers on Writing on KUCI 889 FM. KUCI is broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine, and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and the business of writing. Today, my guests are Judy Blunt and Robert Stone. First up is Judy Blunt. Judy spent more than 30 years on wheat and cattle ranches in northeastern Montana before leaving in 1986 to attend the University of Montana. Her poems and essays have appeared in numerous journals and anthologies. She is the recipient of a Jacob K. Javits Graduate Fellowship and a Montana Arts Council Individual Artist Fellowship. Breaking Clean was awarded a 1997 Penn Girard Fund Award for a work in progress, as well as a 2001 Whiting Writers Award. Judy Blunt lives in Missoula, Montana. Hi, Judy.
Hello.
Great to have you.
Well, it's great to be heard in the far west.
Yeah, the far, far west. Just falling off the continent here in our June gloom summer days. But gosh, Breaking Clean, it's such a wonderful memoir, and it's so unique. Ranch life in eastern Montana. Will you tell our readers a bit about the book and how it came about?
Well, I call myself a reluctant author in that I never truly set out to write a book. It simply sort of happened around me, it seemed like. It's a story of my first years in on a wheat and cattle ranch, a very isolated community south of Malta, Montana, along the High Line or the northeastern corner of Montana. And ours was one of the regions in the United States that the community remained isolated and sort of set apart from society into the 60s and 70s. We got electricity in 59 or 60. We had an outhouse until I was in school. We were, we were not in the mainstream. But what we did have was an incredibly close community of neighbors and friends and that sort of collaborated on earning a living out there. The book itself began as a classroom assignment when I left the ranch and began school in 86. I was taking freshman level courses, of course, and was a severely non-traditional student. But I began writing my Montana experience for a class. And it was the first time I'd ever expressed or talked about my upbringing. It seemed too sort of foreign and embarrassing to talk about, and I hadn't shared it with very many people. And when I finished that assignment, the professor chose it to read aloud in the classroom, and the response of the students was amazing to me. They were riveted by this essay, and that became the first essay in the book, the essay called Breaking Clean, which is written like a prose poem.
I take it then that you were or are probably the first writer in your family.
Well, you know, my mother writes but she doesn't do this silly creative writing stuff. She does, she, for all practical purposes, an incredibly literate, very well-read woman whose vocabulary triggered my imagination in the absence of peers and public school systems and this sort of thing. We had a one-room country school. My mother read voraciously. And although she, would dynamite us out of a chair if she caught us reading, we were not allowed to read except, in moments of calm. It did create the perfect environment to sneak away to read. It made reading a treat. And I learned to read well before I started school. And it, my mother actually published an essay in Linda Hasselstrom, is one of the editors of a book called Leaning into the Wind. And it's an accumulation of stories of Western women, unpublished writers, basically. These are women who simply told their life stories or a segment of their life stories. They had thousands of contributions to the book, and from that, my mother's was one of the ones that was winnowed out and selected for inclusion. So I've got this wonderful book that she has inscribed to me. You know, she was in print before I was, so that was pretty awesome.
So was it difficult then actually writing about your life in such a personal way, writing about your family, writing about your marriage? Were you worried about your mother and other relatives reading this, or did you just never think it would get published?
Well, I knew it would be published because it was the only reason I was writing it is it was under contract. And so, I mean, I had the sort of discovered in a malt shop experience that threw me into a contract when I had 20 pages of classroom assignments written, and I learned to write in the process of writing this book. Hmm. It took me 12 years from the time I first wrote Breaking Clean until the book itself, the manuscript, was finished. It was a burden in a sense, but of course it's the sort of burden that every writer wishes he or she had, you know, writing under contract. In addition to making a living, I was a single parent with three small children. I was putting myself through school and working construction, sanding and finishing hardwood floors. I was attempting to be a dedicated single parent, and I, of course, made my way through school with a double major, working it like a job. I had to have the scholarship money or I wouldn't have made it. And so I, you know, straight A's was the name of the game. And so these entirely separate but equally, you know, amazingly, the force of all of these three occupations, I guess, priorities. I had three distinct priorities in my life. Writing fell in about fourth. Yeah. And so I wrote when I could.
Interesting.
When there wasn't a kid in crisis or a test in, you know, some other class, or I tried to dovetail it into writing for my there were particular professors. Deborah Magpie Erling is one of them, bless her heart, who allowed me to write essays to complete a Native American lit class. Other professors like that who would allow me to incorporate what I was doing into what was required for their class. You know, I cut a couple corners that way.
If you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Judy Blunt, author of the memoir Breaking Clean. Judy, did you, when you were writing this book or writing these pieces for these classes, did you work in a disciplined way? Did you use stolen chunks of time? How did you do it with all your other responsibilities?
Well, I had to focus when I did have time. I had to focus with such an intensity that my children, who were at that time all, I think I had a couple, one or two in junior high, and the other one was still in grade school. We were working in a rental, a tiny little place where my work area was in the living room with the television and the front door and the telephone and these three busy children bustling about. I had to learn to focus so incredibly, to walk back into my story to such a level that my children quickly learned that they could not come up behind me and touch me on the shoulder. I would explode out of the chair.
Mm-hmm.
I was wound down so tight to drive myself into the story and to shut out all extraneous things. They discovered, because we had an overhead light bulb, that they could stand and pass their hand between the light bulb and my computer screen, and it would cause a shadow. And that was how they would alert me that they needed my attention. And so that's how I did it. I mean, I did it getting up at 4 in the morning and trying to write before I would go to work sanding floors. Ultimately, nothing is successful except treating writing like a job.
Yeah.
And what I found is that, yeah, I could write at 4 o'clock in the morning for a while and, you know, tag a 10-hour day onto the end of it. But it couldn't last forever. It had to be a sustained effort for a month or so. And then pretty soon I was getting up at 4 in the morning, and I could sit and stare at that computer screen And it didn't talk back to me. I was thinking ahead to packing the lunch to the jobs I had to go to that day.
Hmm.
You know, the joke or the myth or whatever it is about writing the, you know, bestseller on the subway on the way to work or on napkins from the cafeteria during lunch hour is BS. Writers need to treat writing like a job. They need the, I would call it the luxury of extended periods of time to get into their story. They need to get far enough into it, and it takes a number of weeks or months to do that, that then if they must, they can, what Bill Kittredge would call, leave your tools in the tunnel. You can, you know, leave what you're doing and come back the next day or the next week even, and your tools are there, and all you have to do is pick them up and keep going. And that takes a sustained effort at the beginning. That's where I'm at right now. It's why I don't have another book underway. Is I'm an administrative assistant who spends the majority of my time sitting in an office doing that kind of work.
Mm-hmm. So did it surprise you when Breaking Clean became a national bestseller?
Well, yes, I guess I have to modestly say it not only surprised me, but it terrified me. I'm a far more private person than that book would attest, and there was there was a certain element of disbelief in my writing of it. I approached topics and events without regard to it being read, simply because, you know, the contract was the issue here, not the publication. And it was kind of a shock when suddenly writing a memoir opens you to all a different kind of reading, I should say. Fiction writers just go to bookstores, and the people come out, they will ask them questions about their characters, how they come up with their stories, how much of the stories are autobiographical. There's always that question in a big reading. But primarily, they're hooked on the characters and the stories that are being told. Memoir writers get up there, and man, it's like feeling little dirty fingers looking for scabs, man. they're trying to uncover something about you, or they feel they already know you quite well. And so there's this element of wanting more information about your family and your background, and it can feel incredibly invasive if you're not prepared for it. And one thing that having my book sort of thrown into the spotlight did was create this sort of instantaneous group or crowds of people at readings who would feel they knew me very well, and which is an honor. It's a tribute to, you know, the strength of the story and how it was able to connect with people. But it can be daunting from the writer's standpoint. I had a lot to learn. I had to learn to get on airplanes, and I had to learn to hail taxis, and I had to learn to do all sorts, you know, all sort of things that I kept, you know, when I'd get sent off on this reading tour, I had to keep reminding the publicist, you know, this is autobiographical. I really don't know what I'm doing. I really don't know how to get out there and, you know, do these things. And so you better have the drivers, like, pick me up by the elbow and carry me to the car. Cause I'm not, I can learn, but I haven't done it, you know. The learning curve was fairly steep.
Will you read to us?
I shall.
And again, I'm talking with Judy Blunt, author of Breaking Clean.
I'm going to read a brief portion from an essay I've titled The Year of the Horse, which concerns my little sister Gail's and my relationship and how we came to what I call earn our stories. And people who grow up in families understand that you earn your rep within the family. There's the black sheep, there's the goody two-shoes, there's the responsible one, here's the one that's going to be the dancer. Everyone earns a particular reputation within a family dynamic. And in a family that's raised as mine was, with an oral tradition, this becomes part of storytelling.
Okay.
It's we learned who we were by the stories that were told about us. And this begins, I think, the year I was probably four, and my little sister Gail and her twin brother Gary were three. We were preschoolers.
All right.
Glancing south through the kitchen window that morning, Mother would have seen a landscape limbering up for spring, the faint pastel of budding sage, gray-green over the paler burr of old cactus, a minty breath of willow tips ringing the reservoir. Snowbanks, drawing back from the barn, left shadows on the boards. And a short distance from there, an Angus bull, a recent purchase and nearly full-grown, lies on a knoll, 4 feet tucked under his brisket. The way his features merge in the sunshine, black on black, he might have passed for a hole in the scenery. Only the silhouette gives him away, sloping face, neck humped a size wider than the head, one smooth line drawn tight around a ton of black bull. Still, a bull soaking up the sun, even a large one, was no novelty in our barnyard. What draws my mother's eyes to this one is Gale, 3 years old and all of 30 pounds, rolling on the ground in front of him. Stunned, Mother reaches down and clicks off the burner under a kettle of soup just beginning to simmer. Steam clouds the bottom edge of the glass. In the next deliberate second, she fumbles the latch on the window and pulls it wide. A breeze billows the curtains back, and she stills them with one hand, listening. No crying, nothing but the scratchy rant of red-winged blackbirds in the cattail slough behind the house. Easing the door shut, Mother pauses at the front steps, her eyes skipping to Gary and me, counting heads, even as her hand gropes for the garden hoe, leaning against the house. Our dog, Tippy, falls in behind her as she walks rapidly toward the gate, but the situation calls for a panic of caution. She cannot yell or run toward the bull, nor can she sick the dog on him. A bull lying down is a far smaller threat than one up stomping around fighting a dog. Slipping through, Mother wraps the yard gate shut on the dog's nose and hisses, "Go lay down," the only command Tippy knows besides sick 'em. She slinks back to the front step and collapses. Leaving the gate slightly ajar, Mother slows her pace and circles to approach on the downwind side. The scene defies logic. Gail has shed her cap and her jacket. Her dark pigtails bob on either side of her face as she rocks on her hands and knees in front of the bull. Closer, Mother can hear the sounds of battle. Gail's high-pitched bellows mocking the bullfights we witness at branding time, tongue lolling from her mouth as she bends forward and charges. The bull answers with a slick ripple of hide, tilting his shaggy pole to meet Gale's forehead, butting her back on her heels, nodding as she pushes into him again. Lying with his feet tucked up, his nose brushes the ground in slow arcs as he twists his great head side to side. Then with swift cunning, the bull shifts. Tipping his head in a graceful loop, he hooks the wide bridge of his nose under Gale's chest and flips her like a dime. She shrieks with laughter and is scrambling to all fours for another sally when Mom speaks from a few feet away. "Get back to the house." Her voice is as flat as the head of a nail. She holds the hoe ready to swing. At 3 and a half, Gale must have heard those words with the same sinking heart that Tippy had heard hers. They're training words, ones we recognize as a single sound. That particular command is not one to beg questions. Mother poises for action, the hoe balanced on one shoulder like a baseball bat. Without moving her eyes from the bull, she pushes the coat and the knitted cap together with one foot as Gale passes her, heading for the house. The bull stares after the child for a ways, and then his ears flip back, and his loud breathing stills as if he's been struck by a sudden thought. Mother tenses, her eyes unwavering. She listens for the clank of the yard gate. Seconds pass. The spring sun hums around them, drawing grass out of the ground, drying mud. Then a rumbling, ominous as distant thunder, launches from ground level and gurgles up the bull's throat, erupting in a deep belch. The hoe sags on Mother's arm. The bull settles back, squinting with pleasure, his jaw grinding in easy rhythm around a cud of half-digested hay. By nightfall, I know the tone of this story by heart, as it would be told winter evenings while a pinochle card flicked across the kitchen table and our guests drew long sips of after-supper coffee. There she was, covered with straw right where I by God found her, no bigger than a grasshopper butting heads with an Angus bull. Here a pause for the response, the disbelief. A bull, big as the south side of a barn, her just as happy as if she had good sense. This is the story the neighbors hear. The second part is family business.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
That was Judy Blunt reading from Breaking Clean. Yeah, beautiful writing. It's such attention to detail. Does that come out on your first draft, or is that worked and reworked?
I tend to be a one draft writer, and it makes me a tremendously slow writer. But part of it comes from journalism training, where your first draft was your last draft, and you know, this working with words. I was trained in poetry before I ever wrote prose, and so this attention to the word-by-word progression of a sentence is something that it delays my writing to a certain extent, but it has become simply the process of my writing. I write slowly. I weigh each word as it comes across. Sometimes I'll write three or four sentences in a row and then go back up and sift and sort through them. But I tend to, when I get done, there were, you know, four or five dozen sticky notes from the editor when it came back from, you know, in galleys.
Mm-hmm.
And most of those were trying to standardize, you know, was it the First Creek Hall or the First Creek Community Hall, how I wanted to do things. It tends to make, you know, good drafts, but boy, I'll tell you, two or three pages a day is my crowning achievement. I mean, that would be a really good day for me.
Well, your book, Breaking Clean, is testament to the fact that that if the writing is wonderful, then you can write about anything. You know, some people might say, Montana, selling a memoir about Montana, how is that possible? And it's just, it's a gorgeous book. And Joanne Mapson, actually, a friend of mine, told me about it some months back and loved it so much. She said, you've got to have this woman on your show. So I'm so happy to have talked with you. And thank you so much for coming
on.
Well,
you're very welcome. I'm happy to be recognized by people of Joanne Mapson's caliber.
Oh. My agent, actually, on the air, she was on the air a few months ago before she became my agent, and she mentioned your book too.
Really?
And as a region, you know, because I asked her a question about regional stories, and she said a regional audience and writing about unusual places or places that you wouldn't think would sell can just go wonderfully. And Judy Blunt has written a wonderful memoir about Montana, and she went on and on. So, yeah. Anyway,
well, and you know, I run the risk of becoming the poster child for the disgruntled ranch wives of America. But you know, I'm always quick at a readings to say I write only my own story, and the fact that other people can find a connection to it is incredibly humbling, and it's a gift. But I certainly don't pretend to speak for them. So,
well, thank you. Thank you again.
Thank you.
That was Judy Blunt speaking to us from Missoula, Montana. Breaking Clean, wonderful book. As always, I love the cover, too. I seem to always have books that I love the cover, authors and books. Oh, anyway, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will be here with Robert Stone. So please stay tuned. And you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We have Robert Stone on the line. We'll bring him on in just a couple of minutes. So here we go. Anyway, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and Robert Stone, I have a very wonderful long introduction for him, and I think he's getting himself together to come on the air. Robert Stone was born in Brooklyn, New York in 1937 and educated in parochial schools in New York City. After suffering a crisis of faith, he dropped out of St. Anne's, a Catholic high school in Manhattan, and enlisted in the U.S. Navy. eventually serving as a senior enlisted journalist on a scientific mission to Antarctica. Following a brief stint as a copy boy at the New York Daily News and a student at New York University, he married and moved to New Orleans, where he worked as an actor, an encyclopedia salesman, and a coffee factory worker, among other jobs. This city was to serve as the setting of his first novel, A Hall of Mirrors, in 1967. It was winner of the William Faulkner Foundation Award. Beginning in 1962 as a Stegner Fellow at Stanford University, Stone was able to devote more time to his writing. Around that time, he joined the social circle known as the Merry Pranksters, immortalized in Tom Wolfe's Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. After working as a freelance writer in London, Hollywood, and Saigon, he published Dog Soldiers, which won the 1975 National Book Award for Fiction. His next novel, A Flag for Sunrise, won the 1982 Los Angeles Times Book Prize. His other books include Children of Light, Outer Bridge Reach, Damascus Gate, and a collection of short stories, Bear and His Daughter. He has also received a Guggenheim Fellowship, the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters Award, the John Dos Passos Prize, grants from the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Harold and Mildred Strauss Living Award. Over the past 25 years, he's taught at Amherst College, Princeton University, Harvard, the University of California, New York University, the University of Hawaii, Johns Hopkins, and Yale University. Bay of Souls, his current novel, is also his seventh novel. He has three children, six grandchildren. He and his wife, Janice, divide their time between New York City and Key West. Let's see if he's with us. Robert?
Yes, hi.
There you are. Hello. Great to have you on.
Thank you. Great to be on.
Bay of Souls is such a wonderful book. The language is the best ever. And I wonder if you would talk a bit about the story and how it came to you.
Well, it's about a professor who teaches the fiction of vitalism, that kind of fiction that flourished in the early 19th century in America and in England to some extent, that is associated, I think, with D.H. Lawrence to some extent, and one strand of modernism tends to believe in life, to see life as a kind of a ritual in which you have to engage yourself, risk something, risk your life, risk your soul in order to really take part in it, in order to really be part of it, in order to really live. You have to take a risk. Now, he teaches these books and talks about them to rural college kids in the Middle West, and most of the time he knows that they're not often understanding what he's saying, or they don't have much sympathy for it. He wonders if he has much sympathy for it himself. But suddenly it comes about in his life that he has the opportunity to risk everything for an intense, crazy sexual infatuation that he develops for a colleague, which would be risking a happy marriage, his home, his contact with his son, his job. Everything would be risk, and finally his life. He goes down to an island in the Caribbean where she comes she's from the white planter class. But she is involved in various ways in the traditional Haiti-style voodoo in the island, because a lot of the people in that island came after the Haitian Revolution, bringing some of their religious traditions with them, put it that way. She's going to sell the hotel that her family has run since colonial times. She tells him she wants somebody down there with him. he agrees to go down, although he sees as he gets more and more involved in this that this is going to require an extension of will and courage and folly that he hadn't quite understood. So that's not a very, I don't know how faithful a rendering it is, but that's mm-hmm. one way of pre-seeing the book.
Sure. All of your books seem to have a similar theme, lost souls or people in a certain type of moral or spiritual crisis. Is that how you see it? Or do you not consider theme when you're writing? Do you not think, oh, I'm on this one again in a different facet of this one?
Do you mean different books?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, one interviewer once referred to me as the apostle of the strung out. But no, I never saw myself as the apostle of the strung out. There are certain aspects of American life that I know better than others. But I tend to follow people who get in trouble and who get in trouble because they want something transcendent out of their lives, who want more out of their lives. But then, I mean, you know, there aren't any drugs in Outer Bridge Reach. That's not about drugs. But that is also about someone who wants something transcendent.
In Bay of Souls, did you have the story figured out before you started? Did you know where you were going?
Well, I always sort of know where I'm going. I don't know the exact precise ending. I will usually have a scene in mind toward the end and a general sense of where I'm going. I really can't start if I don't think I have a sense of where I'm going.
Do you spend time on outlines, on plotting?
Well, I spend times on plotting. I have to, you know, I make little summaries of the chapters so they fit, and also so that something hasn't happened that would prevent. I mean, I really plot drives me crazy. I'm not a really dedicated realist. I really prefer poetry and magic to realism, to strict realism. When I can get away with abandoning realism, I do. At the same time, I think you have to have a story. You owe people a story. So I do try to keep the story straight. I don't subject people to things that, you know, couldn't have happened if something else happened. So while I do, and I have in Bay of Souls, abandoned strict realism, I do try to tell a coherent story in realist terms.
Yeah. If you just tuned in, you've missed a wonderful beginning of this show and the last one. Right now I'm talking with Robert Stone, author of Bay of Souls, published by Houghton Mifflin. Voodoo comes into this book. How is that?
Well, I got rather interested in it. Some friends of mine were very interested in it, and I once went to I went to Haiti itself several times, and I had a friend who wanted to be inducted, wanted to really enter into possession with his Loa. Your Loa is the god who possesses you. And he felt he had been possessed at one time, and he went to the ceremony outside of Cap-Etienne, and I kind of stood back in the foliage feeling a little like Abbott and Costello in an Abbott and Costello movie, and watched this this process and listened to the drums. And I'll tell you, it was pretty intense. And you know, I have a great respect for the voodoo religion, because I see that it was a really important survival mechanism for the slaves who were taken to the French Caribbean. It really is something that that they used to pull them through, and it isn't, you know, just a set of black magical curses and dolls with pins in them. There's a wonderful book, if anybody wants to pursue that that line, by a woman named Maya Deren, called Divine Horseman, which I read and used as a guide to the degree that I wasn't researching down there. Maya Deren, Divine Horseman, she spent a year there on a Guggenheim back in the 40s making mm-hmm. films and studying Haitian folk life.
Yes. I recall a film of hers at some point that I saw. Your language is pretty exquisite, and I mean you have many novels. In terms of language, though, how is it for you? How do you know when it's working? Do you read it aloud? Are you listening to a rhythm in your head? How do you get it?
I'm listening to a rhythm in my head. I feel like I'm a musician. I have to trust that it's right. I have to trust my ear. You know, I think sometimes you always get, maybe even as you get older, you get attacks of doubt, and you think, wait a minute, huh? But you've got to have confidence in your ear. And I worked this out. You know, my style came from a lot of early influences, but I think I put those influences behind me. And the style that I write with is now mine, and I think now at this point, as I'm, you know, in my 60s, I begin to see younger writers writing stuff that, you know, I can see is, you know, it's whatever influences were on me, through me, on them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Funny.
Mm-hmm.
But I worked that style out, I think, because it was congenial to me, because in a way it is me. It's the sound of my cerebration. It's the sound of my getting loose and crazy over something.
Hmm.
Not so loose, I mean, my pursuing some notion, pursuing some line of thought, some image, some landscape.
Hmm.
And doing it in a way that I think is beautiful, and doing it in a way that I think sounds right, because I do believe that sound is everything.
Hmm. Do you feel that you write as you talk?
No.
Two
On
different
a scale
things.
Of yes and no.
Two different things.
Yeah.
Will you read to us?
Yes. And I can read the beginning, which is up in the Middle West, or I could read later three pages that are down in the islands, depending on whether...
Why don't you read the beginning?
Okay. "By gad, sir," Michael Ahern said to his son, Paul, "you present a distressing spectacle." A few nights earlier, they had watched the Maltese Falcon together. Paul, who had never seen it before, was delighted by his father's rendering of Sidney Greenstreet. Sometimes he would even try doing Greenstreet himself. "By gad, sir." Paul's attempts at movie voices were not subtle, but commanded inflections normally beyond the comic repertory of a 12-year-old boy from a small town on the northern plains. His voice and manner were coming to resemble his father's. The boy was lying in bed with a copy of The Hobbit open across his counterpane. This time he was not amused at Michael's old movie impressions. He looked up with resentment, his beautiful long-lashed eyes angry. Michael easily met the reproach there. He took any opportunity to look at his son. There was something new every day, a different ray, an unexpected facet reflected in the aspects of this creature enduring his twelvedness. "I want to go, Dad," Paul said evenly, attempting to exercise his powers of persuasion to best effect. He had been literally praying to go. Michael knew that because he had been spying on Paul while the boy knelt beside the bed to say his evening prayers. He had lurked in the hallway outside the boy's room, watching and listening to his careful recitation of the Our Father and the Hail Mary and the Gloria, rote prayers, courtesy of the Catholic school to which the Aherns, with misgivings, regularly dispatched him. Michael and his wife had been raised in religion, and they were warily trying it on again as parents. Sending Paul to St. Emmerich's meant laughing away the horror stories they liked to tell about their own religious education, in the hope of winning a few wholesome, apparent certainties for the next generation. I was 14 before my father took me hunting, Michael said. I think that's about the right age. You said kids do everything sooner. I didn't say I thought kids doing everything sooner was a good idea. You don't even like to hunt, Paul said. You don't believe in it. Really? And what makes us think that? Well, I've heard you with Mom. You, like, agree with her that it's cruel and stuff. I don't agree with her. I understand her position. Anyway, if I didn't believe in it, why should I take a tender runt like you? Paul was immune to his father's goading. He went for the substance. Because I really believe in it. Oh, yes, you believe in whacking innocent creatures? You know what, Paul asked? There was a Christian ethics topic. Hunting was. And I was like, pro, in favor, because Genesis says dominion over beasts. If you eat the meat, it's okay. And we do. You don't. Yes, I do, Paul said. I eat venison kielbasa. Michael loomed over him with his left hand put out on the lamp on the bed table. 'Tis blasphemy to vent thy rage against a dumb brute, he informed Paul. He had been teaching Moby Dick with his favorite assistant, a very pretty South Dakota girl named Phyllis Strom. Now, good night. I don't want you to read too late. Why? I'm not going anywhere. Maybe next year, Michael said. Sure, Dad, said Paul. He left the bedroom door and its customary inch ajar and went downstairs to the study where his wife was grading Chaucer papers. Did he beg and plead, she asked, looking up. I don't think he's absolutely sure if he wants to go or not. He takes a pro-hunting position. She laughed, her son's eyes. A what? In Christian ethics, Michael pronounced solemnly, dominion over the beasts, he argues from Genesis. Christian ethics, he repeated when she looked at him blankly, at school. Oh, that, she said. Well, it doesn't say kill the poor beasts, or does it? Maybe one of those teachers is a gum nut.
Thank you so much.
Right.
That was Robert Stone reading from Bay of Souls, the first three pages. This book goes so many places within the first chapter. It's quite a grabber of a first chapter. Are you thinking that when you're writing? Are you planning for certain things to happen to the reader to keep them there? Or is it the story? Again, we're back to story.
Premeditating everything with the reader in mind, you know, you go with the life of the people. You sort of turn into a ventriloquist.
Mm-hmm.
And those people have their own. You know, they get to have within you. You're doing an imitation, you know. You're doing the voices of people who get to be more and more real as you do their voices.
Mm. I noticed that Bay of Souls is a physically smaller book than most of yours,
yeah.
I would say. Was that premeditated?
Yeah, that was premeditated. I thought I might learn the uses of economy. I thought maybe, wait a minute here, there were several sections, several things I was going to put in, and I suddenly thought, wait a minute. This goes from the end of Them on the Island to this kind of metaphysical scene, and that's where it should end. That's how it should end.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a tough decision, but that was the decision I made.
Yeah. Do you read your work aloud as you're going along?
Well, I read my work aloud, not as I'm going along. I don't. I go on that inner ear. But I certainly read it a lot, you know, I give a lot of readings. So I learn a few things from reading it aloud.
Like?
Like what plays and what doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And what's a little awkward and what would be less awkward.
Yeah. Again, you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here for a few more minutes with Robert Stone, author of Bay of Souls. I'm curious, if when you knew you were a writer, were you a writer as a kid?
I was. I was a writer from grade school. The only thing I did in school that got any kind of positive feedback was my compositions. And I like to write imitation science fiction stories and stuff.
Hmm.
Hmm. I always wanted to write.
Hmm. I wonder also, this is sort of the other end of far from that point of becoming a writer to becoming a writer who's won so many awards. Do they change how you do things? I mean, you know, National Book Award. I mean, what happens after awards? Are you still just getting up writing, or do you feel like now there's a new standard?
It depends on your temperament, you know. I think the thing to remember is you're in just as much trouble when you start your third book and you've won the National Book Award before as you were when you started the first one, in a way. You can be not recognized, or the next thing that can happen to you is you can be forgotten. I mean, early on, I think you have to keep your stuff together. You have to always make it as good as you can be. You can never indulge yourself. You can never, you know, think you're cute. Put your own personal hobby horses out there unless you really think they play.
Mm-hmm.
You got to keep your innocence in a certain way. You got to keep your childlike observation, and you can't take yourself too seriously.
Mm.
I mean, in a way, you have to take yourself very seriously, but, you know, not as a person.
Sure. In the few minutes that we have left, I wanted to ask you about, well, one, the title of the book, and two, the names of your characters, and how important are titles? How important are characters' names?
I think they're important, and I've put more emphasis on some of them than others, but I think titles are important and names of characters are important. Bay of Souls, the standing for that land under the sea. I mean, the hotel is called All Saints Bay, and there is that land under the sea to which the voodoo dead go. So, I mean, that's the role of Bay of Souls in that. And sometimes I'll have a character like who I call like Converse, which is sort of, you know, back and forth, you know, back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, you know, conflicting, contradictory, and so forth.
Yes.
Yeah, character names I think are important.
Robert, we have another minute left. Do you have any words of wisdom for the writers listening, the writers who may be starting out or maybe along the way and kind of stumbling a bit?
Believe in yourself. Keep writing. Keep doing it, because if you stop without some kind of connection, it's going to be very hard for you to ever do it again in later life. It happens. If you believe in yourself, and you must believe in yourself, keep at it. You're sentencing yourself to what is for most people a very difficult and imperfectly rewarding life, but somebody's got to do this. Somebody's got to provide stories on a serious level for this culture. I mean, especially now.
Yes.
And so writers are always needed. It's a profession that's honorable. It's a profession that's useful. You know, artists are honorable and useful. Be brave and believe in yourself.
Mm. I so appreciate you taking the time to come on the show.
Glad to do it.
Thank you so much.
Okay, my pleasure.
That was Robert Stone, author of Bay of Souls, published by Houghton Mifflin. He's speaking to us from New York. If you have any comments or questions, or would like to know about future guests and events in the area, visit my website at writersonwriting.com. There, you can sign up to be on the mailing list. And now I'd like to leave you with a quote by the late and great Irma Bombeck, who said, "Know the difference between success and fame. Success is Mother Teresa. Fame is Madonna." You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thank you for listening. And have a wonderful week.